This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
A few days ago, United States President Joe Biden signed the Juneteenth National Independence Day Act and declared that every year moving forward, June the 19th will be a federal holiday in the U.S. But what exactly is Juneteenth and why is it important? I'm Dashran Johan and this is Today I Learned. On the show with me today is Dr. Mohan Ambige Pagar, Associate Professor of Critical Race Theory and Postcolonial Studies at Tulane University in New Orleans. Dr. Mohan is a Malaysian. He's also the author of the recent protest poem, Killing Ganapati. Welcome to the show, Mohan. Let's start from the top. What exactly is Juneteenth?
Well, thank you for having me on the show again. It's nice to be here and to connect with Malaysian audiences. What is Juneteenth? There's so many levels to answer this question. Of course, on a very basic level, it's about June 19th, the actual day itself, and it's an abbreviation of June 19th. Mm-hmm. The historical significance of Juneteenth in United States history is because it was the day following the end of the American Civil War, a war that was primarily fought around the question of the enslavement of African Americans, and the significance of that being that that's how the entire capitalist system of the United States was organized around, and arguably also the world was organized around slave labor. But 2 months after that war fought around the questions of slavery and global political economy, the Union troops led by General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, and, you know, made a order. It was General Order Number 3 that informed people of African American descent and as well as, you know, society as a whole, that people who have been enslaved and in bondage were free. And this was declared as part of the military governance of the territory that had just been defeated in a war. That is why the date is significant, because this is what happened. That is, in a sense, the commemorative trigger event.
And this is in 1865, right, Mohan?
Correct. It's okay. In 1865, yes.
So then I think most of us are familiar with President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And this was on the 1st of January, 1863. And the United States was approaching its third year of a violent civil war. And Lincoln then declared, and I quote, that all persons held as slaves are and henceforward shall be free. So now this is a historical line. But didn't this end slavery? Because what you just brought up a few seconds ago was in 1865, whereas this was in the Lincoln speech was in 1863.
Yeah, there are a lot of historical nuances you must take into account. So, I mean, an analogy would be, you know, what the Japanese government decreed as laws in Malaya, and then when the British came back and null and voided those laws, you know, this is sort of that kind of transitional moment,
right?
You know, in American history. So when Abraham Lincoln makes his Emancipation Proclamation, you know, the war is still ongoing, and it makes an Emancipation Proclamation based on being the Union government, and the Union forces and government are, you know, represent the United States that did not agree to the secession of the Southern states and them forming their own separate nation. So legally and politically speaking, the United States, you know, talking to a rebel force from their point of view and saying that we have made a declaration about these jurisdictions which we still consider to be our jurisdictions.
Right.
You know, you are a rebel government who we are not recognizing, and we are now fighting to defeat. You're a separatist, you know, government, but the United States is still claiming all of those southern states as part of its jurisdiction. Now, what a Confederate states, I said, we have established ourselves as a brand new nation, you know, but the United States is not recognizing it. And President Lincoln is the president of the old United States that is saying that this is all still ours. And we have just passed a law that says that all the slaves in those territories are free. But the war is still going on. So the Confederacy is obviously saying, yeah, okay, whatever. You know, we don't recognize your proclamation, right? But this is very important because obviously it gives the anti-slavery forces within the southern states, you know, African Americans and others, but you know, principally African Americans, it gives them the signal and the understanding that the war is being fought around this issue. And so the stakes for African Americans are obviously that you know, they have a, in a manner of speaking, if they were supposed to choose, you know, what political options they have, you know, being allied to the Union cause would mean their freedom.
Right.
You know, so because that regime, as it were, you know, has just declared their slavery to be null and void.
Mm.
And so, of course, this is a very important militaristic, political move on Abraham Lincoln's part as well. But, you know, because over the years, it becomes a sort of romantic thing, you know, the nuances are lost. Right. And it's just like, you know, he waved a wand and slavery was ended. You know, it was in the middle of the tactical maneuvering of war and things like that. You know, it's like how, you know, the British kind of played around with when they were going to give us Merdeka. You know, like they were going to give us Merdeka only when they were sure that all their interests in the rubber plantations and tin plantations were secure, then they would give Merdeka. Before that, Merdeka was too dangerous. So, I mean, these were these kinds of, right. You know, in wartime, you know, there's also politics, and the Emancipation Proclamation has to be seen in the context of that still uncertain course of the war. But when Granger comes, which is after 2 months after the war has ended, and General Lee, Robert E. Lee of the Confederacy has surrendered, right?
Right.
Now, this is before internet, social media, and even telegram, right? So, you know, like, oh, maybe they did have telegram. But, you know, it is communication is still quite, you know, limited, right?
Yes.
So the actual news of the end of the war and the consequences of the end of the war and the defeat of the Confederacy and the promises of the Emancipation Proclamation have not yet reached all corners of the former Confederacy, right? So once again, the analogy is like, you know, the Japanese surrender, but okay, in Papan or Taiping or something like that, things are still, you know, catching up on the news, right? But the Japanese have surrendered,
right?
You know, so the Confederacy has surrendered. They have lost the war. But, you know, it takes 2 months for the Union troops to arrive in Galveston, right? And to begin to enforce the new terms. And so there's a big process of governing the defeated territories and ensuring that the social, legal order of the Confederacy is repressed, right? It had to be repressed. That's why the Union troops had to be sent into all corners. These were military administrations, just like the BMA was in Malaya after the war. This was a military administration coming into these various places saying, you know, we are the victorious army. We are establishing governance. And this is new governance. Part of the new governance, General Order 3, everybody here who was enslaved is free.
Right.
You know, and so that is then, there's like, in a sense, an incipient state and a new government with new lawmaking powers, you know, applicable in Galveston, Texas. And since this is the first time that this has been decreed as a order of the military government in Galveston, then it has the force of law. Before, the proclamation did not have the force of law behind it. It was just Abraham Lincoln's tactical war proclamation.
Right.
This has the force of law, right? You know, you are now free. And we are the state saying that you are now free and nobody can hold you back. Nobody can enslave you. You are free. You know, all the former political, institutional, legal, criminal infrastructure around holding people as slaves, African Americans as slaves, is now null and void. It's done. The war has been fought. A new regime is to begin. And this is what happens in subsequent things like the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, and all of that.
How many years altogether were Africans enslaved in the U.S., including, you know, those moments up to 1865? How many years were they enslaved in the U.S.?
That's a very difficult question and a subject of lots of different kinds of controversies, going on. It's hard to say because, you know, the form of slavery that was abolished, you know, by the Civil War was chattel slavery. You know, like the idea that people can be owned as a private property, just like you own your iPhone or you own your car or house, that you can actually own another human being.
Right.
And you can own their progeny, you know, for onto the generations. Is they are your private property to be owned. You know, George Washington, you know, these were all the big billionaires of the time. They were the Donald Trumps and Jeff Bezos of the time. I mean, you know, what is the source of their wealth? Washington's, you know, I think had 300 plus slaves, you know, that he owned. That his wealth was in people, human beings, you know. I mean, he even extracted the teeth of his slaves to put, you know, teeth into his own mouth. You know, this is some of the most macabre, manifestations of a society that licensed the owning of other human beings, you know, and the depravity that it created. You know, there's so many layers, to that. When you allow such things to happen, it corrupts all kinds of humanistic, you know, sentiments and feelings and morality. So this all happened, and these are the great celebrated figures. I mean, Washington was a slave, major slaveholder. Jefferson was a major slaveholder, right? Their wealth and property and business interests were in owning human beings. However, you know, chattel slavery, you know, develops, you know, prior to the establishment of the United States as a republic after the American Revolution. But, you know, the United States also has this earlier colonial history where it's part of the British Empire and it has the early moments of colonies. And the early years of the colonies, you know, there was already the transatlantic slave trade going on in the British Empire. I mean, you know, this is connected to slavery taking place in British provinces, you know, colonies like, you know, in the Caribbean, in Trinidad, Jamaica. This is part of the global plantation owning colonial interests that are sort of expanding and growing in the Americas and the Caribbean, you know, in this what people call the triangulated relationship between Europe,
right,
Americas, and Africa, right? Like people are being taken from Africa. Business interests like sugar plantations and whatnot are being cultivated in Jamaica, but Louisiana as well, and then later cotton and, you know, things like that. And then this is being invested by, you know, capital from Britain, you know, cotton grown in the fields of Mississippi and the Deep South are being exported to where, you know, to Manchester, to be turned into what? You know, British textiles. British textiles are then being sent to India to replace the Indian textile industry,
right,
with industrialized cloth, right? So this is the global economy. Capitalism is this international system.
Right.
It was already an international system at the time we are talking about. So to say, like, how long have they been, you know, enslaved is a difficult question because European colonial world had already established trade in African slaves prior to the establishment of the American Republic. The French also were engaged in slavery. I mean, you know, if you think about the Haitian Revolution, you know, what was that about? You know, that was the most successful slave revolt in modern history, where slaves were able to revolt and establish their own government and kick out the slaveholding empire, you know, and establish the Haitian Republic. And that had aftershocks. You know, even in Louisiana, we had the 1811 Destrehan slave rebellion, where slaves started to move up. They rebelled in the Destrehan plantation,
right,
and they started to move up the Mississippi River, freeing other plantations, you know, in the wake. And they were only put down when the federal government sent troops and quashed the rebellion. This is all very incredible history, and history maybe that people, you know, even the United States don't know very much about, you know, because we're kind of given the sanitized,
whitewash version.
Yeah, you know, yeah, the feel-good version of history. But, yeah, you know, it's important to recognize how we are also connected to it. The fact that we have the abolition of slavery is also connected to, you know, all the revolts and dissent and movements, you know, that move to make slavery gone from the British Empire. And that,
yeah,
included the history of the Haitian Revolution, the slave revolts in the U.S., the abolition movement in England. You know, all of this contributed. You know, to answer your question, it's not a simple answer. I,
yeah,
can't put a figure in it, because it's, you know, the owning of slaves and the feeding of slaves and the search of capitalism to find populations to exploit, you know, in this sort of, you know, extreme ways is a part of the very nature and character of capitalism. Whether it was from a few centuries ago, even today, we see these dynamics taking place. So there's a part of the development of this multifaceted global capitalist system that has, you know, has very long roots.
So very long roots indeed, but it all came to an end, or at least somewhat of an end, especially when we look at American history, on the 19th of June, 1865, when the,
yeah,
general stormed into Texas and said, you know, enough is enough, the slaves are free. So, but what then is the difference between what happened then and also the adoption of the 13th Amendment that took place in December of that very same year? What's the difference and what's the significance of the 13th Amendment?
So the 13th Amendment, once again, is the federal structure. You know,
okay,
this is, so we in Malaysia, we have a very similar kind of structure to the United States. We are also a federated structure with individual states, right? So the United States, after the end of the Civil War, was facing, as I said, this issue of how to readmit and give back the status of federal representation to the states that had tried to secede. But, you know, they are now conquered states, but they are going to be readmitted into the Union, right? But under, obviously, certain kinds of conditions and laws. So what the United States Congress, you know, during the period that's called the Reconstruction, is very concerned about is that they know, of course, I mean, they were defeated militarily, but the Southern white sentiments, you know, wanting to maintain the way of life, slavery, the lost cause, as some people put it, you know, was still quite high. So how were they going to create a sort of legal infrastructure to stop these states? Once you bring back the state, you know, like, so you know, say Selangor seceded, tried to secede, but they was defeated, brought back. But what is to stop the Selangor state government from passing laws to say that slavery can come back again? There was nothing stopping the readmitted states, you know, to go on their own state by state basis and return everything back to normal once they have been readmitted into the Union. So the entire federal constitution had to be amended.
Right.
And that is
okay.
the 13th Amendment, to say this is a law of the whole United States and its jurisdictions. That means whether it is Guam, whether it is a naval base, whether anything that is under the United States jurisdiction, we have just made it a constitutional crime to have slavery again. So it then blocked any individual state from being able to be a renegade and say, no, in our state, we are going to make the Selangor law and say, that says this is okay in our state. But once the federal structure is very explicit, right? Remember, the federal structure
yes,
you know, was condoning slavery. I mean, George
right.
Washington was a slave owner.
Yep.
So it was all legal. But the new constitution after the Civil War with the 13th Amendment made it illegal to institute slavery, chattel slavery, you know, anywhere in the United States jurisdiction, including the defeated southern states.
On that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. I'm speaking with Dr. Mohan Ambike Parker, an associate professor in critical race theory and post-colonial studies. And we're talking about Juneteenth, the day slavery properly ended in the United States. We'll be back on Today I Learned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Today I Learned. I'm Darshan Johan and I'm joined by Dr. Mohan Ambike Parker, an associate professor in critical race theory and post-colonial studies at Tulane University in the US. And we're talking about Juneteenth, which is the day the last slaves in the United States were emancipated, you know, as opposed to after the Emancipation Proclamation 3 years earlier. Mohan, when we look at Juneteenth, what is the significance of it today, and how is it celebrated? Are there any like rituals? Has the way it's celebrated changed over the years? Talk to me about this.
Yeah, I mean, it has been celebrated for a very long time. It has been celebrated principally by the African American community, you know, steadfastly since the end of the Civil War. A very important date, you know, a day of remembrance for people as they think about their ancestors. And, you know, how the struggle of their ancestors gave them their freedom and their ability to exist, you know, as free people. Sometimes Juneteenth is also known as Freedom Day or Independence Day. So this is a very monumental, significant day for African Americans in their community life. And, you know, my first encounters with Juneteenth was, you know, when I was a graduate student at the University of Texas, Austin, and, you know, communities in East Austin, African-American communities would celebrate Juneteenth, and they would virtually be alone in celebrating it in any kind of popular way or prominent way.
Right.
You know, those would be the only communities sort of making the effort to celebrate it, because actually, you know, Texas had already, I believe, declared Juneteenth to be a state holiday in 1980 or something like that. And the majority of states in the United States, like on the state level,
right,
had already recognized Juneteenth as a state holiday. Maybe most of them didn't make it a paid holiday. I mean, it was just like a recognized day. You know, you still come to work, the stock market, banks are still open, but we recognize this is a day. And maybe you can have the option to give your employees a day off, but very important to that particular community. And this, of course, is an incredibly important national, you know, event, right? This restructures the entire United States after the Civil War. And yet it has been a very submerged, under the radar kind of holiday, only taken as being very meaningful by the community most directly impacted, you know, by it. But one can say we all were impacted by it, because had all these amendments not taken place, the United States would have gone in a very different historical direction, right? So it should have been celebrated. It should have been made as a opportunity for education and tool. But instead, you know, it was diminished and sidelined as sort of a minority thing that nobody really took very much interest about or didn't seem to think it was very prestigious. Nothing along the lines of July 4th or any of these other major holidays, you know, to be celebrated as sort of a patriotic thing. But this should have been a very patriotic holiday. It was the moment where the United States rectified some of its huge flaws, its huge humanistic and moral flaws in moving forward. But it was not like that. And so this federal holiday now that Biden has put into effect, you know, seeks to try to elevate the status of Juneteenth, you know, into a much more meaningful way. And with it being a federal holiday, federal employees, you know, well, it adds to the paid holiday. Now, U.S. doesn't have as many paid holidays as Malaysia has. You know, we only have, I think, around 11 here, inauguration days, an additional one when it happens once in 4 years. You know, there's about 10, 11 holidays, right? So I think this is maybe the 11th.
We have one every other week.
You know, so this is a big deal for people, yeah, too. And for federal employees, it's, yeah, a paid holiday, right? Which is very scarce in the United States. So, you know, I think the elevation of this to make it a much more meaningful, a much more nationally recognized event, provides opportunities to re-educate people about the significance of Juneteenth, not only for African Americans, for whom, of course, it is very important, but there's nobody living who is untouched by the changes and reforms that the United States went through. And Juneteenth is the significance, for that. But of course, there are also paradoxes and contradictions around this particular moment. But
what do you mean by that?
Pause here for a moment. Well, there is also, quite fair criticisms because, this holiday, I think, it came about as a result of the incredible, social protests that was unleashed in the Black Lives Matter movement that has been happening for several years, but certainly, yes, achieved a real peak, after the killing of George Floyd and the way that the movement then went into a global arena. And many people point to the fact that it's very easy to make a public holiday, gesture as a new administration coming in, seeming to do something for the issues involved in the racisms of the United States, but they're not really addressing, the underlying structural and ongoing questions of abuse and discrimination and violence that are impacting the community. So, just like governments, want to be seen to be delivering on their agenda, this is a very soft,
right,
soft gift. Doesn't cost anything except one day of work.
Yes.
Maybe. But, so you find all the southern states, only 14 congressmen from the Republican Party, oppose the holiday. So everybody is okay with the holiday, sure.
Exactly.
So it was a low political cost for Biden, right? And can be seen as such a big symbolic thing. But the critique, I think, is very important. If this is all he's going to do to address the burning issues that led to this moment, then it becomes very cynical of his administration to be using the declaration of this holiday as any kind of meaningful change. It's not meaningful change.
And that's what I wanted to ask you as we wrap this conversation up, because it's a couple of days after the 19th of June, as we just mentioned, it's declared a federal holiday this year onwards. Great step, but as you said, it's nothing compared to actually doing the work in terms of, pushing for progressive policies that's actually going to make meaningful change, right? Juneteenth, even if you're a member of the Ku Klux Klan, you're happy it's a holiday because you don't have to go to work. So, but we take the small victories and whatnot, but it's been a long time since slavery was officially abolished in the US. We now have a federal holiday to sort of mark that. How do you reflect in 2021, sitting here today, how do you reflect on the struggles of the African Americans today and the journey that lies ahead?
Well, it's been an incredible story. It's something that, has touched human history as a whole. I mean, the kind of struggle and resistance and meaning towards freedom that the African-American struggle, and the struggle of enslaved African people all across the Americas, right? I feel that, so much has been accomplished, right? And this has been a multi-century struggle. The struggle is not over because these systems, that were present in 1865 have morphed and changed into other kinds of systems, have incorporated, bigger populations, but, the story is not over yet. Some of the same communities in the United States are still fighting the afterlives of the consequences of slavery, disenfranchisement, lack of opportunity, lack of access to, the basic indicators, social indicators that can make life survivable and meaningful. This is still a struggle for so many African American communities, in the United States. It's still being targeted. I mean, which communities are the ones being suffering in COVID-19? I mean, why is it the African American community and Native American communities that are seeing the highest death rates? Is it somehow magical that is happening, or is Are these, even these things, deeply tied, you know, to the iniquities that were structured and continue to be unaddressed, you know, since the 1865, you know, moment? You know, and if I were to tell you that you were free one day on Juneteenth, but you and your family have not had capital, wealth, except the clothes on your back, and you're like, you're free. Okay, what are you going to do? Start a McDonald's franchise chain the next day? I mean, you know what? You know that. How is the struggle over? Yes, you're technically, no one is allowed to own you anymore. That is huge. That is huge. But you know, did the United States do enough to actually provide meaningful equality, you know, for people who have been dispossessed for so long? I mean, obviously not. Obviously, it did not happen, right? You know, and they, and you know, the Reconstruction period after Civil War, what's called the Reconstruction Congress, only lasted 12 years before actually the Southern states were able to reassert themselves, right. Not militaristically, but they were able to reassert themselves into national politics again, and they advanced their interests, you know, white supremacy interests. They brought up white supremacy constitutions in many states in the South, explicit white supremacy constitutions within this new constitutional framework. Even within, they weren't able to do what they were able to do before, but they created new kinds of oppression and new kinds of dispossession. Okay, they're taking away, African Americans were now citizens, could vote, but they imposed new kinds of voting restrictions. And all of those things are still something we are seeing today with the new attacks on voting. After Biden's victory, so many states are trying to create restrictions on voting. This goes all the way back to 1865, because the United States all of a sudden were facing the enfranchisement of 4 million people, 4 million new voters. It is right. Like the young voter issue in Malaysia. The prevailing government and powers that be do not want to deal with enfranchised voters. So it's been a long story of how to control the African-American vote, you know, how to diminish its impact. It started in 1865 and it's continuing today. So all these shenanigans are going, but where does this come from? This comes from 1865, when on the day African-Americans learned that they were free, at the same time, you know, the political movements were already beginning afoot to try to repress their ability to function as equal citizens inside the country. And that struggle is still continuing, and it still has consequences for presidential elections or Senate races or congressional races. It's still being fought over, you know. So I think that, you know, in that regard, I've given you two examples in political realm, you know, how the fight continues to not allow oneself to have your political voice taken away,
right.
And or in social terms, you know, in like whether your communities are thriving or the well-being of the communities, you know, do they have access to health care? Do they have access to equitable medical care? Things of that nature. Who are doing the frontline work? You know, we saw the rich in New York and other places run as soon as the pandemic hit. Who was forced to continue the economy? No, it wasn't the rich who were running away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their work allowed them to run away. You know, but they insisted that those who are doing frontline work, you know, had to continue to man the economy so their profits can flow. But of course, that meant you would be exposed to the conditions of the pandemic in the early days.
Yeah,
and so the death rates of the people doing the frontlining work, the grocery stores, you know, the sanitation work, all of those work. Who are the people doing those work? We come back to the same communities again. Why? Is that just by luck? Or is that because this history we are talking about has shaped it to be so? You know, so whether you're talking about your political voice or whether you're talking about the social conditions, you know, these are struggles that are still being fought.
On that note, Mohan, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
That was Dr. Mohan Ambike Parker, Associate Professor in Critical Race Theory and Post-Colonial Studies at Tulane University, New Orleans, enlightening me on Juneteenth, a holiday to celebrate the emancipation of the last slaves in the US. So if you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Today I Learned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.